The controversy over Iowa's for-profit Medicaid management found its way into federal court this week. We'll find out about it this hour. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Health reporter Tony Lays of the Des Moines Register tells us about the lawsuit against the state filed by six Iowans with disabilities. Also, why a state council rejected a new state-financed family planning program. IPR's Katarina Sestaric explains the concerns of rural Iowa hospitals. Also, a new study that shows the suicide rate among farmers, still a big problem, and the 70th annual International Juggling Convention coming to Cedar Rapids. Buckle up for your News Buzz. First, this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This first half hour, a number of items that deal with state medical care issues. In a few minutes, I'll be talking with IPR's Katarina Sestaric. She'll explain the concerns of rural Iowa hospitals in particular about the possible loss of Medicaid expansion under the Republicans' new health care proposal. That's going on in Washington, the Senate now. Talking about that behind closed doors, we're hearing. But first of all, this week, a state council rejected a new state-financed family planning program that's slated to take effect on July 1st. Also, remember that decision to shift management of the Medicaid program to private companies here in Iowa? Well, a handful of Iowans who are receiving Medicaid services are suing the state over the way their cases have been handled since that transition last year. Tony Lays is with us, health reporter for the Des Moines Register. Nice to have you back on, Tony.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Let's talk about the legislation that was passed last year. Remind us, last session, I should say, to defund Planned Parenthood and forgo some federal money. Give us some background here.
Well, the background is the law says that any healthcare agency that provides abortions cannot participate in the state-funded family planning program. And that program has been part of Medicaid, which is a joint federal and state program. And under the federal rules, you can't bar agencies that way. So by setting up a separate state agency, they're foregoing $3 million in federal money for this effort.
Mm-hmm. And Planned Parenthood, you reported Planned Parenthood of the Heartland closing clinics in Iowa in response to the state legislation, right?
Right.
So what happened this week?
Well, there's a council. It's mostly an advisory council to the Department of Human Services. It's called Iowa Council on Human Services, and it rarely makes news. But they voted 4-1, forgive me, on Wednesday to reject rules implementing this law, which is on the books. This happens so rarely that nobody at the meeting, including top administrators and the board chair, knew what the effect of a no vote was. I think this is going to be a short-lived story because they're meeting again this afternoon to reconsider their vote.
Mm, so what were the reasons they gave in their rejection in the first vote?
A couple reasons. One is doubts that the supporters say that this won't affect access to family planning services because other clinics can step in. There's been some significant doubt about that, and some of the council members shared those doubts. And also, turning down $3 million of federal money at a time when they're cutting millions of dollars in other Medicaid services didn't make sense to some of the council members.
Mm-hmm. As you reported also, it's interesting that the council members on this 4-1 vote all were appointed by Governor Branstad, right?
It's true. They're all volunteer citizens, and they stood up and spoke their minds. Like I said, it's not clear what the effect of that would be because the law does say this is what's going to happen July 1st. So.
Any anticipation on if they're getting together this afternoon to meet again, these council members?
My hunch is they're not getting together again to give the exact same vote, but we'll have to see.
Okay. Also, isn't it reporting here that this new way forward would bar unauthorized immigrants from participating in this new state-supported birth control program?
True, and the Medicaid administrators pointed out that that's the current rule under federal Medicaid.
Okay.
The chair of the council said, well, now that we're doing a state program, can't we change that? And she said, theoretically, yes, but the law is what the law is, and she has to follow what the legislature passed.
I saw a graphic, or actually a video, on the Des Moines Register website. I wonder if you could share some of the results of the Des Moines Register's and Mediacom's poll about this area, considering Planned Parenthood and the efforts to defund it by the state legislature. What do Iowans think about it?
Well, forgive me, Ben. I don't have those numbers off the top of my head. The poll did show that a majority of Iowa voters do support state funding to Planned Parenthood, as long as that funding doesn't go to abortion, is my recollection of that poll.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the lawsuit filed this week against the state, against Governor Kim Reynolds, filed by six Iowans with disabilities. What do they claim? What do they want?
Well, the lawsuit is organized by advocacy group Disability Rights Iowa, which was set up by Congress. In every state has a group like this to fight for legal rights for people with disabilities. And the key claim on this lawsuit is that the managed care companies that Iowa hired last year to administrate the Medicaid program, that they've been cutting in-home services that these folks depend on to live in their homes or out in the community instead of in nursing homes or care facilities. The lawsuit, the key claim really is, they cite there's a landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision, it's called Olmstead from 1999, where the Supreme Court determined that folks with disabilities do have a right to live outside the care facilities if their needs can be, and the standard is, reasonably accommodated. And this is under the Americans with Disabilities Act, is what the Supreme Court ruled. And so the lawsuit is saying that by cutting these in-home services, the management companies are in violation of that decision.
Mm-hmm. And you spoke with some of the plaintiffs?
We did. We spoke with two of the families.
Mm-hmm. So give us an example of the concrete problems that are faced by a plaintiff in this case when that funding is cut.
So these families, a lot of them are in self-directed programs where they hire staff to come in and help the person with disabilities with all kinds of daily activities. And the management companies have been sending letters, in some cases, cutting the hours that are allowed by more than half and saying that we don't think you need these, and also that these hours are over a limit set in state policy. What the families are saying and what the lawsuit says is that when the state used to run the Medicaid program, administrators often granted what they called exceptions to policy, and that for just such cases where they said, look, we understand that you need more than what the policy is, and you've shown that you do, and so we're going to grant this exception. What the lawsuit says is that the managed care companies have clamped down on that and aren't willing to do that.
Mm-hmm. How has the state government reacted to this lawsuit? Have they reacted yet?
Not really, which is no surprise. I mean, they just got hit with it on Tuesday. So there have been lawsuits like this in other states. They don't tend to go to trial. They tend to get negotiated. What the plaintiffs are asking for is a judge to give an injunction ordering the state to stop doing this. It's interesting that the lawsuit is filed against just the governor and the head of the Department of Human Services and not against the Medicaid managed care companies. The plaintiffs say that the state is ultimately responsible for how the program gets run.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So a problem with oversight, is that what's in this lawsuit?
Well, one possible remedy that the lawyers for the plaintiffs are suggesting is that these 15,000 to 16,000 people get taken out of managed care and put back into a state administrative Medicaid program. Keep in mind that this is a pretty small number. There's about 600,000 Iowans on Medicaid managed care now. This is 15 to 16,000 of them. But these are some of the people who have the highest needs and are the most expensive. It makes sense because they need help every day. So they're saying maybe what we do here is not have them be overseen by the managed care companies.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned in your article there have been precedents in other states, lawsuits mm-hmm. similar to this. What has their success rate been?
Well, the plaintiff's attorneys pointed to several states, California, Minnesota, North Carolina, and Oregon, where there were agreements reached between the plaintiffs and the state to change what they were doing. So that's really what they're after. I mean, theoretically, this could go to trial, and these folks could be up on the stand testifying in front of a judge or a jury about what the problems are. But it's more likely that this will be a negotiation going forward.
Okay, thanks for the reporting. Tony Lays, health reporter for the Des Moines Register. Nice talking with you, Tony.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, as we've been hearing in the news over the past few days, the Iowa Hospital Association is concerned about the proposed new replacement to the Affordable Care Act, to Obamacare, the American Health Care Act. The Iowa Hospital Association is concerned specifically about how that proposed health care law would affect hospitals in the state, especially those in rural Iowa. Iowa Public Radio's Katerina Sestarek has been reporting on that and talking with CEOs around the state. She joins me now. Hello, Katerina.
Hi, Ben.
So what are you looking for? What are you looking at in this feature?
So what I'm looking at is basically how cuts to Medicaid could affect rural hospitals. Rural hospitals tend to serve an older and sicker and poorer population. A lot of farmers maybe who aren't getting like employer-based insurance like people do in cities. So they are more dependent on Medicaid than hospitals often are in rural or in urban areas. And so they could potentially see some really big financial impacts, which is a problem, especially for them, because they already usually operate on such small margins. So what I've been talking to with CEOs in rural hospitals, especially in eastern Iowa, they've been saying that they're very concerned about the proposal in the House bill, to repeal and replace Obamacare, that would roll back Medicaid expansion.
Mm-hmm.
After Medicaid expansion, rural hospitals especially saw a big drop in their uncompensated care. So that's when they provide care to patients, let's say like in the emergency room, but right. then the patient can't pay for it. They're uninsured. So the hospital basically just ends up taking on that care for free.
Right. And the ones that weren't paying, that number went down because the number of insured across the country, as in Iowa, went up due to the Affordable Care Act.
Right. And so, you know, one hospital CEO told me before Medicaid expansion, or if Medicaid expansion hadn't happened, they would just barely be breaking even right now. And because of Medicaid expansion, they've got a pretty comfortable margin to work with. So that's really helpful. And a big thing, too, is just these hospitals in rural areas. A lot of times they're one of the biggest employers in the area.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're not doing well, you know, maybe a lot of people in the community aren't doing well because they work there. And also, if a rural hospital were to close down, as they have been in states that didn't expand Medicaid, that could lead to a whole bunch of sort of domino effect things in the community. You know, people don't want to live where they can't get health care. So that would be a big issue.
And we have a lot of uncertainty at this time. It was this past weekend that Republicans announced they saw a path to repealing Obamacare through the Senate. Now, it passed the House, as you mentioned, several weeks ago. If the Senate bill passes, and this is a bill that's being discussed by about a dozen Republican senators right now behind closed doors, so what, we don't really know what's in it, right?
We don't know. They're still expecting some pretty heavy cuts to Medicaid. And so last week at a press conference with the Iowa Hospital Association, their board chair, who's also the CEO of a small hospital in northeast Iowa, he was talking about how Medicaid expansion helped a lot of people in his community get their health problems under control, and it's also really helped reduce his hospital's uncompensated care, so we can hear from him.
It's essential for our well-being to have that happen, and you know, across the state, there are small hospitals who run on pretty thin margins. And today at the board meeting that we had, every hospital in Iowa was starting to see their margins thin with all the changes in healthcare. And to lose the expansion money would severely jeopardize many of the smaller hospitals' operating margins.
And so that was Mike Myers, board chair of the IHA, and he is basically just expressing that concern about Medicaid expansion being cut.
Mm-hmm. So is the Iowa Hospital Association lobbying congressional members in Iowa who go to Washington?
Yeah, they have been working on that. I believe next week they're going to D.C. to meet with the congressional delegation to express their concerns further.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the populations that these hospitals in rural Iowa care for. What types of people typically come to these hospitals?
Well, they're usually a bit poorer, sicker, older. Definitely the aging of the population in rural areas is also a big concern for these hospitals because, of course, you know, as people get older, they often need more health care, more services. And if they're not insured, then hospitals are sort of, you know, picking up even more uncompensated care costs.
Okay, Katerina, we'll be watching for your reporting on how the new health care law that's making its way through Congress may affect Iowa hospitals and specifically rural hospitals in Iowa. Thanks, Katerina.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A quick set of conversations to end our news week here. Number of suicides among farmers has remained stubbornly high since the end of the 1980s farm crisis, much higher than workers in other industries. Wendy Rittenberg is with us, an assistant professor at Des Moines University. She's one of the co-authors of this new study published in the Journal of Rural Health. Wendy, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the study. What did it examine?
So what we did, we have seen and other research has shown that farmer suicides have continued to be high. And we also wanted to look at all types of intentional harm that result in a fatality. So we wanted to look at both homicide and suicide of farmers and agricultural workers. What we did is we took 19 years of data that had been collected over the years by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It's a census of fatality information incurred while someone is working.
Mm-hmm.
So we took that data and did some analysis. And what we found is that when you pull farmers and agricultural workers out of all of the other populations of workers, they consistently, and through all 19 years, they had a higher rate of suicide than all those other combined occupations.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that begs the question, well, we know that there are some peaks and some valleys in this, but what is it that consistently happens for farmers and agricultural workers that caused them to be at risk for suicide?
Right. And during the farm crisis, I don't know what our numbers today, how they compare with the 1980s farm crisis when that was in its worst state. But there you have actual families losing their farms and a real reason to be depressed about the future. But not so today, right?
Well, we still see that financial stressors certainly cause a great deal of distress, especially for farmers. We did find that people who were more likely in this population to commit suicide were self-employed and worked in an environment of less than 10 employees. So it could be anywhere from 1 to 10. So it does seem as though the financial burden mm-hmm. may have a huge impact, but there are also other factors that have been researched, and further research needs to be done here. But we do know that there's a potential for people who are working with pesticides to have greater depression, and perhaps that leads into it. We also find that people who have been disabled or who live in pain, such as some, you know, older farmers, that they decide that they're going to take their own lives because of that. We also see suicides happening because of a lack of, you know, what do I do if I'm not going to be a farmer? What happens if I lose my land? What happens if I'm no longer functioning in that capacity? And that has also been a reason why some people have committed suicide. After the 80s, you know, there were some mental health services that were created and provided specifically for farmers and agricultural workers. A lot of those are no longer in existence. So promoting mental health, especially mental health for people who live in rural areas, would be one fantastic, you know, benefit that we're hoping to see come out of this study.
Right, and I suppose we were talking a little earlier in the hour about concerns about rural health care, hospitals in the rural areas of the state, looking to Medicaid payments and reductions there, that quality health care plays a role.
Absolutely. Not only quality health care, but having it accessible for people who, you know, so that they don't have to drive 2.5 or 3 hours to get to medical care or to get to mental health care or to get to someone who can perhaps identify that they may be in crisis.
Now, I think this study looked at different regions around the U.S. In mm-hmm. terms of the suicide rate among farmers. What did you see there, differences?
We saw some very interesting differences. And as this study looked at intentional harm, we did comparisons between farmers and ag workers who had been victims of suicide versus those who had been victims of homicide. And what we found, there were four different areas that geographic regions that we had used from the census description of that. And what we found is in three of those, they were just incredibly different in the percentages. So in the Midwest, there were almost three times as many suicides as those who had been homicide victims, whereas in the South, there were three to almost four times as many victims of homicide versus suicide. And then in the West, they were almost equal for suicides and homicides.
Well, what would be the reason for that difference? Big difference.
You know, it's a fascinating question, and we're not exactly sure. There have been some research activities that have been done to look at how the South categorizes violence, and that in one study, at least, we know that violence seemed to be more acceptable in the South, and that could be part of why the homicide rates are higher for this population. But honestly, we don't really know. We don't know why there are such incredible differences between the Midwest and the South and the West.
Now, Wendy, I understand you were a farm girl, have a farm background here. So you really understand this culture, culture that says, you know, if a farmer has some problems, some needs, you've just got to sort of suck it up and go on, right?
That's a pretty good way to put it. Yes, my background, I come from a century farm over in Belle Plaine, the Wurman farm. And why I had wanted to go to the University of Iowa to study occupational safety and health is because they have an agricultural safety and health program. And my grandfather had actually died after complications of a power takeoff injury. So I was very interested in injuries and certainly those that are fatal for this population. But then we started, when I was in school, that's when there were Craigslist murders that had come to light, that farm workers had been attracted to go I can't remember the location, but they had gone and three people had lost their lives.
Mm-hmm. Before we have to go, Wendy, tell us, do the findings of this study that you've co-authored suggest any remedies?
More programming. We need to reach out with mental health services to everyone in the rural areas, especially farmers and agricultural workers. We want to make sure that we're helping them identify risk factors of depression or those indicators that would put them at the high risk of committing suicide.
Okay.
So we want to be able to reach out.
Wendy Rittenberg, assistant professor at Des Moines University, co-author of a new study, Trends and Characteristics of Occupational Suicide in Farmers and Agriculture Workers, published in the Journal of Rural Health. Thanks for telling us a little bit about it, Wendy.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And when we come back, we'll talk with Iowa's interim insurance commissioner. He'll tell us about the stopgap proposal he has made to prevent the collapse of the insurance market exchange here in Iowa. When we continue, it's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
And we're back midstream in this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with some quick conversations to end the week. That's what we like to do on Fridays, our News Buzz edition. The Manhattan Project produced the world's first nuclear weapons, and the Ames Laboratory which played a vital role in that project, is 70 years old. Monday during this hour, we'll be looking back at the Manhattan Project's part the Ames Laboratory played in the Manhattan Project, and the rest of the storied history of the Ames Laboratory. I talk with the director of that lab based at Iowa State University, not only about history, but also about current innovations. How about 3D printing to produce exact replicas of your bones if they wear out? Or new technology that could revolutionize refrigeration? Listen in Monday as we celebrate the Ames Laboratory's 70th anniversary. Well, as we've been hearing in the news the last few days, Iowa's on the brink of having no health insurance options on the individual marketplace. That's where some 72,000 Iowans buy their health insurance. So far this year, all three of the individual health insurance carriers have said they might or will leave the market because of uncertainty and because of heavy losses. Wellmark, Medica, Aetna, those are the three insurers. So the state's interim insurance commissioner, Doug Ullman, is proposing a stopgap plan that he says could prevent the market's collapse. He joins us now, Doug Ullman, interim insurance commissioner for the state of Iowa. Welcome to our program.
Thank you. Good afternoon. It's good to be here.
Good afternoon to you. What's the plan? What are you proposing?
This is a stopgap measure that's really designed to deal with the current circumstance. As Congress continues to debate whether to repeal and replace or reform the ACA, what's really clear is there needs to be some changes. And so what we did is we took a look at what was happening in our market after Aetna and Wellmark announced that they were departing. That would impact 53,000 Iowans, just those two carriers that are in the individual market. Started to try to put together a plan that could serve as a stopgap to deal with the 2018 calendar year that's coming up. Because even if Congress acts, we're really concerned about whether or not we'll have something in place. What it's designed to do, it's designed to prevent a collapse of the market and to allow carriers to continue to participate. We've seen large numbers of healthy and young individuals depart, and that's got to be reversed for the commercial market to be able to operate.
How does this plan do that, and what does it cost?
Now, what we do, what we're asking for is to redirect the subsidies that are already flowing into the market. And some of the numbers, frankly, are astounding. But if you look at the individual market, the ACA-compliant market, it takes right around $450 million in premium in order to support the individuals. And many of the individuals in this market are paying premiums. But we estimate that about $240 million of that dollar is actually flowing into our state through the form of premium subsidies. And so we're asking to redirect those subsidies to do a modified income-based subsidy along with an age-based subsidy in order to make it more appealing to young and healthy individuals to come back in.
Mm-hmm. So I understand you went to Washington, was that this week, to sort of pitch this plan?
Well, we've been in Washington a couple of times over the last several months, but we have met with federal authorities. And because everything is now regulated or controlled by federal law, it's as an insurance commissioner, I do the numbers. I mean, I do rate review. We do the numbers. We need to know what it takes in order to keep a market working. But because a lot of the restrictions are in federal law, I can't really do anything unless I get permission from the federal government to do it. So, yes, I've been to Washington a couple of times as recently as last week, and we've had some good meetings.
Who do you meet with? I mean, is this something that elected officials, our congressional delegation can influence, or is this really in a different level?
Well, in the final answer, of course, Congress has got to act because the rules have to be reset. And I think you'll hear from individuals across the political spectrum that there needs to be a reset of the rules. So we've met with those individuals, both our congressional delegation, senators, trying to help give them some information that would be useful in that effort. But on this proposal, this is what we're seeking is administrative relief, and that that resides with the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Tom Price, as well as with Seema, Administrator Seema Verma, who is the administrator for what we call CMS, but it's the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid.
Mm-hmm. I guess also what I'm really asking is on behalf of the listeners who, well, you know, we said 72,000 Iowans buy their health insurance through this individual marketplace. Can they have a voice in whether there's in this stopgap plan in Washington?
Yeah, we've put the plan on our website, and as part of that, we are receiving comments on it. So that's one place they can go. Under any administrative action by the federal government, there is a comment period. So please, if individuals have looked over our plan and they view it as something that they believe is better than what I'm concerned we may have, and that is nothing, you know, certainly we would encourage them to comment on that. But, you know, reaching out to any elected official, I believe would be important in this process. You know, we really do need action. And you can see what's happening across the country, especially for those of us out here in the Midwest. We really are kind of running into a problem that the federal government's just got to fix. And we can't be in this circumstance going year to year wondering whether or not Iowans have coverage. It's just simply unacceptable.
Doug Oman, how optimistic are you that this stopgap plan you're proposing will be approved?
We are really under tight time restraints. And so I'm optimistic because I'm an optimistic individual. I wouldn't have started down this path if I didn't think we had a good chance of success. But it's going to take a lot of lifting. The laws are, to some degree, they're against us in so many ways. But you know, our view is that what is more important than some of that is that we get coverage available to people here in Iowa. And these are our neighbors. And this may be, I'm sure some of the listeners are impacted by this. But these are people we see every day. It's a significant amount of our population. And as I mentioned, it's just not acceptable to not have an individual market. Yeah, there's been a lot of frustration over the increasing in rates. That's due in a large part due to the fact that our individuals with persistent health conditions have had those costs distributed into the individual market. But there's needs to be general spend, kind of more general subsidization on those individuals. I mean, they're people that need care. But to simply place that cost into the households of a relatively small individual market here in Iowa just simply is not going to work.
A couple of other quick questions. In your discussions with people, the deciders, the regulators in Washington, other people with influence, is the adoption of this stopgap plan, is it partisan in any way? Does it receive a different response from Democrats as from Republicans?
Again, it's not perfect. I am sure that as the debate continues and there's an effort to reset policy, there will be differences based on politics. But I think what I've heard from most quarters is this is something that's useful, important, necessary where we stand right now. And mm-hmm. So I would say, I mean, I've met with both our state Democrats as well as Republican leadership here in our state. And I think what's really clear is it's not acceptable to not have a market. And that's, you know, there's broad consensus for that. Again, this is not perfect. I'm not suggesting that it is perfect. I think that there's got to continue to be some debate. But certainly we've got to have resolution. It does not work in a commercial market to go year in and year out having discussions about resetting the rules. Insurance is the business of predicting. And when we set rates and approve rates and review rates, you know, that's being done based on what we expect the rules to be. And it just is not going to work to continue to have debates over what the rules need to be. It needs to be set. We need to agree to it. There needs to be some political consent, and we need to let people move on with their lives.
Doug Oman, very quickly, when will we know, thumbs up or thumbs down to this stopgap plan?
You know, we're going to see progress. I think we're going to see some positive indications as we move forward. But ultimately, we've got to know no later than July 1 about whether or not this is going to work, because the carriers, as well as the state, is accepting a fair amount of responsibility in trying to move forward. You know, enrollment isn't until November, and certainly that gives us a little bit of time beyond that July 1 date. But we've got to we've got to get some answers here from the federal government.
Doug Holman, thanks for coming into our studio in Des Moines, Interim Insurance Commissioner for the state of Iowa, giving us that bit of explanation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben. Have a good day.
The American dream. It's always been based on this idea, this dream of individuals achieving great things, no matter what humble beginnings they start from. In other words, upward mobility. The Equality of Opportunity Project has just come out with a map that shows the geography of upward mobility here in the United States. Mike Droste joins us. He's research assistant at Stanford University in California, working with this project. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Ben. Great to be with you.
Great to have you on. We have 5 or 6 minutes to talk about this. I'm looking at the map on your website. Describe the map and what it represents.
Sure. So some of our recent research has focused on, I guess, what you could call the geography of upward mobility in America. And so one particular measure that we've looked at is children's chances of reaching the top 20% of the income distribution, given that their parents come from the bottom 20%. And one surprising find from our project is that this number varies considerably across space within the U.S. So, for instance, nationally, that figure, the share of kids born into the bottom 20% of the income distribution who reach the top 20% is around 7.5%. However, if you're born in the, say, the Deep South in Atlanta, say, that number is closer to 4%. And if you're born, say, in Des Moines, that number might be around 15%. So considerable variation across space. Another thing that we find is that these differences are driven mostly by differences in childhood environment rather than differences in, say, later life labor market outcomes, or perhaps, for instance, employment opportunities would be different for kids growing up in Atlanta versus Des Moines. What we find is that that is not important in driving these differences.
So, Mike, to sum up Iowa, Des Moines, you've mentioned a couple times, Iowa as a whole fares pretty well in this comparison of upward mobility.
That's right. Yes, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. What do the best places have in common? I know one of the questions that you looked at was how neighborhoods affect economic opportunity.
Right. So our research identifies basically five factors that tend to be related to these differences in upward mobility that we observe. So these five factors include lower levels of residential segregation. So to what extent do the rich and poor live together? A larger middle class. So to what extent is the population in a given area not spread the tails of the income distribution? Stronger families, so we find that places with low shares of two-parent households tend to have lower rates of upward mobility. And one important thing to note about that is it's not really driven so much by your own environment. So to analyze that in more detail, we look, for instance, at children who are born into two-parent households but grow up in areas with lots of one-parent households, and we find that those differences outside of their own family also seem to be related to their later life outcomes as well. We also find that social capital tends to matter. So this goes back to the adage of it takes a village to raise a child.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, we see that Salt Lake City, Utah, a classic example of an area with high social capital, say, tends to perform quite well in our rankings. And we also find that high-quality public schools tend to matter as well.
Mm-hmm. Mike Droste, how do you hope this data will be used? How do you hope your project's information will be used?
Well, our hope is that we can find better government policy to ameliorate the impact of growing up in areas with low opportunity. So in the past, there have been some limited government experiments that have, for instance, there was one in Chicago in the 70s called the Moving to Opportunity Experiment that basically gave vouchers to low-income families to move to better neighborhoods. And that led to substantial increases in those children's earnings as adults, increases in college attendance, reductions in out-of-wedlock births, all sorts of outcomes affected by that program. So I guess the overarching goal of of our work is to identify local government policies that can improve rates of upward mobility.
Okay. Mike Droste, research assistant at Stanford University, working with the Equality of Opportunity Project. Thank you, Mike.
Great to speak with you, Ben.
I'm Ben Kiefer, Friday News Buzz edition almost to an end. And, of course, it's an hour when I juggle a handful of different topics. Finally today, though, real juggling. The International Jugglers Association is holding its 70th annual juggling festival here in Iowa this year, in Cedar Rapids. It will be a week of jugglers performing and competing in Cedar Rapids. Daniel Holzman is with us, International Juggling Association Festival Director. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, Ben. Pleasure to be on your show.
Wonderful to be with you. What an honor to have the International Juggling Festival here in Iowa this year. Tell us more about what's featured at the festival.
Well, gravity better beware because the jugglers are coming. We're in Cedar Rapids the whole week from the 10th through the 16th. We have four big shows at the Paramount Theater, and all our activities will take place at the Cellular Convention Center attached to the DoubleTree Hotel. We'll have shows. We have activities like joggling, which is jogging and juggling at the same time, water scuggling, which is water skiing and juggling at the same time, and workshops in juggling and aerial as well.
Wow.
At the Cellular Center.
So you've got all ranges of jugglers, professionals as well as amateurs, beginners. Can anyone come?
Sure, even if you don't juggle at all, it's just somebody who wants to learn to juggle. It goes from hobbyists to the greatest professional jugglers in the world.
Mm-hmm. So you're a juggler. I see in your bio you've got some interesting things here. You were on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Also, Robin Williams, you toured with him for years.
Yeah, I was a professional juggler for 35 years. I just retired at the end of last year. And my career really started in 1984 when my partner and I were on The Tonight Show. And we got to tour with many famous comedians, including Billy Crystal and Robin Williams and Howie Mandel, were three of the biggest ones.
I see here on your bio, you have to explain this. You performed for the O.J. Simpson jury during that murder trial?
In showbiz, you're always trying to get promotion. You're always trying to get some kind of publicity. And we had heard that performers were going in on the weekends to perform for the sequestered O.J. Simpson jurors. So we sent a letter to Lance Ito, who was the judge, asking if we could perform. And we got permission to come in on a weekend and do our full one-hour show for the jurors in the courtroom where the trial had taken place.
And how was that?
It was very interesting because I was a big follower of the case. I had grown up in Los Angeles, and I had my very strong opinions about the case and whether O.J. was guilty or not. And when I saw the jury, I thought, oh, he'll never be found guilty. I didn't think that they just sort of seemed like they were having fun, and it was sort of a lark to them almost. And I just felt like they had lost the case in jury selection.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay, back to juggling.
Yeah, exactly.
How does juggling affect your brain?
Well, they had a study, and the study's a bit misleading because they chose juggling as a new complex skill. So the idea is that learning a new complex skill will change the white matter in your brain. It improves the connections. And when they did juggling, they found the brain changed, especially in areas affecting reaching, grasping, and peripheral vision. They thought the white matter at a certain age could not be affected or changed. And by learning a complex new skill, and they chose juggling because a lot of people have no experience with juggling, it demonstrated the brain actually does change when a new skill is brought into the person's life.
Mm-hmm. How fast can you teach someone to juggle?
I would say the average person about 5 minutes can learn how to do it, to master it.
With three balls?
Yeah, about 5 minutes to understand how to juggle. But it's like they say about Texas Hold'em, minutes to learn, but a lifetime to master.
Are there some people who just you give up and say, go find something else? Croquet, that's a good sport for you.
Well, when I was a kid, people always say to me, you must have really good coordination. And I took up juggling because I thought I had bad coordination. As a kid, I felt pretty klutzy. So when I saw a book about juggling, I thought, oh, if I learn to juggle, that will help my coordination. And now, I mean, you'd think that I'm like a panther, a 55-year-old panther. My reflexes and my coordination is amazing after 35 years of juggling. So I think juggling is a great thing for people who don't think they can juggle.
Mm. What are the strangest things that get juggled these days?
Well, people love the danger objects like chainsaws and fire. In fact, there's a buskers event on Saturday morning on the Farmers Market, July 15th, where we'll be breaking out our danger props. Like in our competitions, like we have in the theater, we won't do fire or chainsaws or high unicycles. But Saturday morning, we'll break out the danger stuff and do shows for the people in the farmer's market. So everything will be juggled in Cedar Rapids July 10th through the 16th.
Mm. Is there an easy way to define juggling? Because you see a lot of things that are called juggling that are very different.
That's funny you ask, Ben, because actually at the festival, in addition to a big history museum, there's sort of an important lecture that's going to be called The Definition of Juggling. So that idea has been debated quite a bit. What is juggling? And for the first time ever, there's going to be a lecture that tries to actually have a definition for juggling.
I need a whole lecture. I've only got 30 seconds for you. You have to compress it.
Well, to me, juggling is the manipulation of objects in a creative way, whether it's a yo-yo or a frisbee or a shaker cup or your car keys. If you throw your car keys behind your back and you want to catch them in a fancy way, you're juggling.
Okay. I've done that.
Fidget toys I don't think are juggling, like the spinners.
No juggling.
It's sort of a no-brainer. But when you choose to do something creative and you choose to do something artistic with an inanimate object, to me, you're a juggler.
Okay. Daniel Holzman, thank you very much. The International Juggling Association Festival Director talking with us about the festival coming to Cedar Rapids July 10th through the 16th. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton, with help today from Robbie Broad. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. On Monday, we help celebrate the 70th anniversary of the Ames Laboratory. We'll help you. Hope you will tune in then. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.